Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome back to the Athletic Baseball Show for Thursday, July 13th. This is Stephen Nesbitt filling in for DVR, who spent his week moving across the country. And I'm joined by Keith Law, who has spent his week writing thousands and thousands and perhaps tens of thousands of words about the MLB draft. Keith, how you doing?
20,000 plus words. And I flew across the country. Does that count?
That very like much
partial
counts.
Partial credit? Okay, cool.
That very much counts. On today's show, we're going to go deep on the MLB draft and touch on a few takeaways from the futures game. So let's jump right in, Keith. The top five of the draft were the top five. They were the ones that were expected. No surprises. Nobody cut an underslot deal. So you go Pirates getting Paul Skeens, Nationals Dylan Cruz, Tigers Max Clark, the first high schooler off the board. The Rangers, Wyatt Lankford, and Twins, Walker Jenkins, before the A's go and do an A's thing and get Jacob Wilson. So first off, I implore you, the listener, to go read all of Keith's stuff. There's so much there, so much good content. If we don't talk about your team here, he talked about them there. So read all that on The Athletic. So top five going sort of, I guess, not chalk necessarily, because they could have gone in any order based on what the Pirates decided to do. What did you make of the way the top five shook out?
Yeah, so it was 3-1-4-2-5 going on my board. I mean, that's chalk. That's chalk enough for me. I said all spring was kind of the eye of the beholder with these guys, where, you know, just sort of which... Do you want high school or college? Do you want the one pitcher who's in the mix? Do you want a little more upside with maybe Lankford or even Jenkins in the long term? Or do you want the absolute, you know, high probability offered by someone like Cruz? But they're all great. They were all great players. They were all guys who could go first overall in the typical draft. I mean, my one big observation here is I'm a little surprised that the Pirates picking first overall, which they did 2 years ago, A, took the pitcher, who's just higher risk. He just is, right? Yeah. Even before we talk about the fact that he throws 100, sits 100 as a starter, pitchers just, they get hurt. The good ones get hurt. You know, even when they don't throw super hard, even when it's not high effort. I don't think Skeens is a high effort delivery, but he throws harder than any starter I think we've ever seen, certainly for his age. So there's risk there. And based on the rest of the draft, I don't think they did the thing they did 2 years ago where they shaved and then went over with multiple later picks, Bubba Chandler, Anthony Salamedo, Lonnie White. Doesn't look like they did that this year, which if I was going to not take, you know, I had Skeens third. So if I was going to say I'm taking the third best player, obviously they might think Skeens is the best player. But just from my perspective, yeah, they didn't take the best player or the second best one, but also didn't use any savings to go overslot. And so that left me feeling a little meh, not bad about their draft. I don't think they had a bad draft by any stretch of the imagination, but I look at the rest of what they did and I'm not blown away by what they did. I think they had a better opportunity and they didn't capitalize.
Right. And talking to people in and around that organization this week, it seemed like they brought, I think, a lot of options to the table into the last week. They considered a couple different guys and could have gone. One factor, I think, was because their next pick wasn't until 42 and a couple of teams drafted multiple times between there. I think there was some concern they weren't going to get the person they wanted at 42. And so if you go under slot at number one, then you may have made a big mistake there. But the deal with the Pirates is just that is a caliber of pitcher that is not available to them in any other way, unless you fully develop that person. And so Skeens is an arm they'll never sign in free agency. It would never never work for them. And so that was their shot. I thought they would have gone one of the college outfielders the whole time. I thought Langford if they wanted to cut a deal, or Cruz, because that's your, it's your best hitter available. So it made for an interesting rest of the draft, to touch quickly on it for them, because they go the Michigan State shortstop Mitch Jebb after that, Xander Muth, high school pitcher, Garrett Forster. It was not a really overwhelming haul, considering the advantage that the number one team has.
They took one high schooler, right? I don't know if they took, did they grab somebody late? They grabbed a one guy in the 17th round, I assume, and a Puerto Rican high school player in the 15th round. But in the top 10 rounds, they took one high school player. It was Xander Muth, who for all the world looks like a reliever to me, and I do not like that class of player. High school pitchers who strongly project to be relievers go to college. I'm very much not interested. It's a low arm slot. He gets compared constantly to Tanner Houck, who's never been able to get lefties out in the big leagues. And I don't see why Xander Muth is going to be any different. And if you want to take that guy out of college, great, all day long. But to take that guy out of high school and maybe overpay him over slot, at least, that's your one big investment after the first pick. I kind of don't see it. And I like Jeb. No upside. Very steady. You kind of know what you're getting. Forrester not on my top 100. Patrick Riley, kind of famous in high school, nowhere close to the top 100. I mean, it's just not, it's not a wow, right? Skeens really has to be what he could, right? He has to kind of hit his ceiling for the Pirates to walk out of this and say, we did it. We nailed it. And maybe that happens. Maybe he becomes your number one starter, like you were talking about, the kind of guy they can never get in free agency. And then no one's going to even think about what else they did in the draft if he becomes that guy, especially if he becomes it soon. Because I do think, I mean, if I were in Ben Charrington's shoes, I'm thinking Skeens, maybe he pitches in fall league this year. He starts next year in Double A Altoona. And the idea is get him to the big leagues quick, because he's not going to, you're not waiting for anything. So you're not waiting for him to throw harder, certainly. And you have to just assume the clock is at least a little bit ticking on him.
Right. Yeah. With a guy with that skill set and that velocity, you're always going to be worried about injury. And with any pitcher coming through the system, and yeah, he's a guy I think will move pretty quickly. Certainly isn't going to be a not an opening day guy, I wouldn't expect, for multiple service time reasons, but a guy I think we'll definitely see in Pittsburgh next summer. So that will be obviously someone to watch going through the system. But I think it left an interesting situation for the Nationals at two, because they, I think, sort of expected that Skeens was gonna be there, and it's an easy decision for them to make. And they sort of end up having to, air quotes, settle for Dylan Cruz, the best player of the draft, right, at number two, and pretty fortuitous, right?
Yeah, because everyone said all spring they wanted Skeens, or for most of the spring. I mean, it's the most Mike Rizzo pick of Mike Rizzo picks, right? A giant college starter, especially in a major program, who throws super hard. Like, how could he not, right? Why have a draft room? Why just, right? You're just going to, obviously, you're going to take that guy. And when he was gone, they took the next best guy. And, number one on my board, most famous player in the draft, I think. You know, I guess it's him or Skeens, certainly. But Cruz has the long track record, too. I've said this many times in many places, but, like, I first saw Dylan Cruz as a high school junior, and he was already kind of a guy back then. At least, hey, keep an eye on this guy. He's going to be a first-rounder next year. And then COVID hit, and the world changed. He goes to LSU, and all he does is rake for 3 years in the SEC. You cannot be upset with that pick if you're a Nationals fan. And I will say they did – what they did was pretty interesting, where they didn't have any extra picks, but with the first pick of day two, sort of knowing they'd get whoever they wanted, they targeted a huge, hard-throwing high school pitcher from Texas, Travis Sikora, who I know a lot of folks thought was first-round caliber. And it looks like they're basically just going to push any extra pool money they had into him. So they kind of bet very heavily on two guys in this draft class, going for upside and figuring, you know, maybe we got two or even three, if you consider the second round or first round ish type players. Yeah. Like, I get that I like that. I like that philosophy. And I think it's served Rizzo and company well many times over the years, just saying we need first round caliber guys, right? Go get the best prospects you can. Hey, if you got a punt, you know, round 6 through 10, they took a bunch of fifth year seniors, right? Those are like $1,000 guys. It's the happy to be here crowd. You always hope one of them gets to Double A and does well enough that you're glad you took him. but it's pretty clear where all the money's going here. And I like that. Like, I get it. Maybe I wouldn't have taken exactly that bucket basket of players, but I like the strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. They end up Dylan Cruz, Yoandy Morales, third baseman mm-hmm. out of Miami, and Travis Sequoyah, like you mentioned, in the third round. It's a pretty nice top couple picks. And yeah, front loading it, especially in this draft, may not be the worst idea with the type of first round talent that was going to be available a little bit lower in the draft. So, okay. The Oakland A's, this was telegraphed, forecasted. This was, you saw this coming. They were going to make a decision that wasn't necessarily the consensus number six pick there at number six. Mm-hmm. They take Jacob Wilson. We've discussed this guy on the show. He's got an incredible hit tool. He struck out, mm-hmm. what was it, 12 times?
In 2 years.
In two seasons.
Yeah.
So it's going to work. I would imagine this is a pretty... pretty easy bet to be a big leaguer. I just don't know how much of an impact big leaguer he's going to be.
Oh, he is a big leaguer. It's funny. I was talking to a scout just before the draft to a guy who likes Wilson quite a bit more than I did. He said, that guy is a big leaguer. And as in, you are getting a major league player. The probability of Jacob Wilson not getting to the big leagues, barring, injury or he retires to join the priesthood or something, is pretty close to zero. He's about as sure a big leaguer as there was outside of the Cruz Skeens group. So I understand that, but today's game, you need to hit the ball at least a little bit hard, a little bit of the time, and Jacob Wilson does not do that. And he hits the ball into the ground all the time. I had somebody the other day, another front office person, basically saying that, like, it's great that he hits everything. He just hits it all into the ground. So what have you really got there? And if you're taking that guy at 22, great. At 22, the probability of getting a big leaguer has already started to drop. And the higher ceiling guys come with a lot higher risk down there. They picked sixth. Now, granted, they picked sixth in a five-player draft, and okay, woe is them. There were plenty of good college players still on the board. Matt Shaw, Kyle Teal, who they had been linked to, Rhett Lauder, who went one pick behind, Tommy Troy. They had lots of other options. And I liked some of their picks. Second, third, fourth round, I think they did pretty well. But that, to take that guy at six, I don't get it. You're the A's. And for the short term, at least, it's like what you were saying about the Pirates getting a Paul Skeens type. The A's could go get a Jacob Wilson type somewhere, free agency, trade, whatever. But they passed on some guys of the caliber that they're not going to be able to go get otherwise, certainly not in free agency. And frankly, their trades haven't worked out great the last couple of years. So they missed an opportunity here, and that's disappointing.
I mentioned the Pirates didn't have their second pick until 42. The Reds had three picks in the top 43, and mm-hmm. I think they hit a home run. Love the pick they made at seven mm-hmm. with Rhett Lauder out of Wake Forest. At 38, they took Ty Floyd, who we saw in the College World Series, right-hander out of LSU. And then at 43, they got Sammy Stafura, the high school shortstop. And I think all three could have been first-round picks.
I totally agree. In fact, maybe in my last mock, I had all three going in the first round. I mean, Floyd was getting rumored. There were teams in the 20s saying, we don't think Floyd gets to us. So I don't know what changed necessarily. There was a lot of talk that Floyd and whoever his advisor was, I actually don't know who it is offhand, were trying to find a better deal somewhere up. And maybe that sort of manipulated things. There's a lot of that stuff, especially in the 24 hours leading up to the draft. No knock on Floyd at all. Get the best deal you can. But I love... there's a pretty clear philosophy here. And I just love the Reds drafts more. 3 years out of four, I come out really liking their drafts. And I like the fact that they keep drafting towards round 10. They love to just say, hey, yeah, it's the seventh round. It's the sixth round. So what? There's good players. They took a good college junior, Ethan O'Donnell, a center fielder from UVA, who can definitely play center and hit a little bit without power. That's a good sixth round pick. But I love what it really looks like at the top of the draft. You mentioned two really good college pitchers. They took another one in the third round, Hunter Holland, who had a minor knee injury and tried to pitch through it, but he lost probably about 3 miles an hour off his fastball in the process and then had a cleanup as soon as Arkansas season was done. Would not be surprised at all to see him throwing quite a bit harder next spring. So you take three pretty good college starters with three of your first four picks. And you mentioned Stafura, a high school shortstop, who definitely stays there. He's a 70 runner. He's got feel to hit. There's a little stuff you want to do with the swing, but if he's maybe a leadoff on base guy who can really run and definitely stays at short, that's a hell of a front four, even before considering some of the players they took after that who I thought were at least good value for where they selected them.
Rounding out the top 10 here, just a couple more guys. Blake Mitchell to the Royals, Chase Dolander to the Rockies, and Noble Meyer to the Marlins. The Mitchell, is this just cutting a deal with a high schooler they can do something with later? The biggest surprise of the first top 10.
It was, I think, the biggest delta between maybe where I'd ranked somebody and where he got taken. We'd all heard. I definitely had Mitchell. I was on the radio with Soren Petro in Kansas City, and he said I was the first person to say the Royals were on Mitchell, but I can promise you I was not the only one. And it seemed like they were on catchers. Him and Kyle Teal, those were the two names that came up with the Royals the most. The thing is, I look at the rest of the draft, and I'm not sure where the money goes. Right. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Usually you can peek at a draft. I mean, you've looked at this for a few years now. You get it, right? You can look and say, that guy's probably overslot, that guy's not. And I'm looking, I pulled theirs up. You know, Blake Walters will probably get a little overslot in the second round, but then they took a way under slot guy, I think, with the outfielder they took with their comp B pick. Hero Wyatt was their first pick of day two in the third round. He's probably a bit of an overslot guy. And I wonder if Hunter Owen coming out of Vanderbilt, there's any, because he was supposed to be, we talked about him, I think. You and I have talked about him at one point where, you know, he could have been a first rounder if he'd just been healthy all spring. So does he get more than fourth round money to get him out of Vanderbilt and say, don't go back for a fourth year? Maybe. But that's a whole lot of, I don't know, right? We're discussing this. You would like to say, yeah, okay, well, they went under with Blake Mitchell the year they did it with Hunter Dozier. And then the turnaround, we didn't even get to the second round. They took Sean Manaea. It's like, mm-hmm. Oh, okay, I get it. I totally get it. I know what you're doing. Great. Love getting that combination of players. Awesome. Here they took Frank Mozzicato, which was a fall out of your seat kind of moment. I was sitting next to J.J. Cooper, and he turned to me, of Baseball America, and he turned to me and said, it's Mozzicato. And I definitely used a word I won't repeat on this podcast, but it was the equivalent of, are you kidding me? But then they turned around and they took a couple over slot guys afterwards. And I thought, whether that works out or not, they spent the money well. I don't know here, right? If Mitchell comes in under slot, I'll be very curious to see where that money gets spread around. And if he comes in at slot, Mitchell is not a bad prospect. I sort of ended up in this conversation with Soren yesterday where it's like, I'm not digging on the kid, right? This is nothing against him. He's a good prospect. He's not eighth in the draft good, right? And there's no insult in saying a guy is 20th or 25th in a draft class. That's still very good. And it gets you $2 million, but there's a difference between being there and being eighth. And it's never a kid's fault if he gets drafted higher than any of us think he should, but it does sort of, that was one when they did that. My first thought was, who are they spending the savings on? And then the draft, as the rest of the draft came out, I had what we're just saying. I don't know. I'm not sure if I can make that math add up, and I'll be curious to see where all those dollars come in the next 2 weeks.
Right. If you're desperate for a catcher, Kyle Teal was available. He goes at 14 to the Red Sox, and that's a guy much closer to the big leagues. So we'll get to him in just 1 second. But as we round out the top 10 here, Noble Meyer was kind of part of a 1-2 punch for the Marlins. Like you wrote, they have a type. They end up with Noble Meyer, best high school arm in the draft, and then Thomas White, lefty out of Phillips Academy, Andover, just about 30 minutes from my house here. Big kid, big lefty who is a Vandy commit and was going to need a lot of money, I'm sure, to sign. So, what did you make of what the Marlins did at the end of the first top 10?
I don't know if you ever got over to see Thomas White too, but it's like I didn't see him in the spring because he pitched on Saturdays almost all spring. So I was generally out seeing college guys almost every weekend. It's bigger than a college guy. He throws really bigger than a typical high school guy. He throws very hard. There's good secondary stuff. I had people questioning the delivery, but he was pretty clearly the best high school lefty in the draft. Noble Meyer was pretty clearly the best high school righty in the draft. I wouldn't draft this way. Just I've written and I'm like a broken record on this, right? With high school pitchers in the first round are a bad risk. You are absolute base rate neglect. For those of you who've read my book or read Thinking Fast and Slow or any of the dozens of books talking about this stuff, they are ignoring the higher failure rate of high school pitchers particularly those taken in the first round. That said, they took the two best in the category. Okay, sure. You know what? If the whole industry is going one way and you say we can walk out of here with the best high school right and the best high school lefty, okay. But that's not a bad outcome, right? There are worse ways to do this. You could do this and take two guys who just weren't that good. They didn't do that. They took two pretty good ones. And, again, nothing against these kids. And I'm certainly not rooting for anything to go wrong. I'm just recognizing the history of the draft and saying that, you know, that these guys fail. The attrition rate is just that much higher. They fail to reach the majors at a higher rate. They fail to succeed at a higher rate. And especially, again, when you pick 10th, like I was saying about picking 6th or 8th, all these guys, it's who you left on the board. There are years where you do that, and that's fine. But this was a year where there are lots of good players left on the board.
Remind me, do you do a mid-season re-rank of your top 100 prospects?
I do. Thank you for asking.
Roughly?
And that will be running later this month, I believe. So I will be and it's going to change a lot from this offseason, for sure.
Yeah. Roughly, not to make you make your picks right now, but those top three college guys in the top five, Skeens, Cruz, Langford, like roughly where do you see them landing in the top 100 at this point?
My guess, and I've only just barely started to sketch any of this out, but my guess is you will see of the top five, they'll probably be all in the top 30 or so. I tend to run pretty conservative on those guys because they haven't started in pro ball, and because we see plenty of examples where we see plenty of examples of guys where they struggle, you know, unexpectedly the moment that they get into the big leagues. That they get into minor leagues, where like Elijah Green, he was top 10, I think, on everybody's board. And he's got over 100 strikeouts already in his first season in pro ball. And that's a guy who's really killed by the absence of short season baseball. It's where he belongs. But yeah, there's enough variance with those guys that I try to just be conservative on the first list, let them get out and play. And then I can be a little more aggressive in ranking them once we've got even just a tiny bit of data with the wood bat against better competition.
There are a couple of first rounders I want to touch on, but let me open it with this question. What's a team outside the top 10, so after Meyer, that you feel like really nailed the overall package? So maybe has a lower pot of money to hand out, but ended up doing something pretty good with the picks and money they did have.
That's a great question, because the Reds has been my stock answer the last 2 days for who did I think did the best out of anyone. I liked what the Mets did. The Mets didn't have a proper first round pick, and I thought they did exceptionally well. It was really, and they did so by going largely through the college ranks. But their first pick was a high schooler, Colin Houck, who I think for much of the spring, folks thought he was going to go in the top 15. I certainly did. And then I wrote, I think the day before the draft, hey, it seems like Colin Houck is sliding. I didn't think he was going to slide to 32, yeah. Certainly. I'm going to assume that's over a slot. It was great, too, that I'm assuming you caught this, but they drafted Brandon Sproat again, the guy they drafted last year in the third round who didn't sign. And I didn't even know if he'd sign the consent to reselect. Without that, they wouldn't even be able to take him. But they turned around, took him again. It's like, you're going to freaking sign with us. So, I mean, he's a senior now. He really doesn't have a whole lot of choice. They took Nolan McLean, who didn't sign last year with the Orioles, but I think they listed him as a two-way player, but he's a pitcher. I mean, he strikes out way too much to be anything more. Maybe he's like the occasional bat off the bench and hey, just swing really hard and see if because he can hit a ball 500 feet pretty easily. But as a reliever, he can move fairly quickly. Cade Morris was a college starter from Nevada who I just really liked as a kind of a sleeper right in that range. AJ Ewing's a high school hitter I particularly like. Like, that's a pretty good package. They took some college relievers or reliever types who are really interesting. For not having a first round pick, that was really good. You know, versus the Dodgers, the other team didn't have a first round pick, where I hate to say it was bad, especially because they're the Dodgers, but I was like, the heck is going on here? I don't recognize the Dodgers. This is like the Dodgers or something drafted instead.
I was going to ask that. Next one is, any clarity on what the Dodgers were doing? Like, have you figured out in the few days since what their plan was?
No. The info I've gotten has actually been worse since the draft, right? I can't, you know, people don't like Kendall George. He's an 80 runner. I get that. Center field. He's small. He doesn't hit the ball hard. There are hit tool questions right now. Jake Geloff, second rounder, I liked, appropriate for the pick, actually probably good value for the pick, but a guy with a flaw. I mean, you can throw 95 in the upper third of the zone and he does not hit it. And he offers at it a lot. And there's, that is a big thing to try to overcome. I just think the upside, if he does overcome it, is pretty good. Brady Smith, high school pitcher whose velocity went down as the season went on. Eric Swan at Middle Tennessee State was one of their extra picks between the fourth and fifth rounds. And the comment I got, I'm going to have to paraphrase slightly, but he's up to 100. He walks everybody. But the comment I got was, you know, guy says, I went to see him and the bat boy for the other team was looking to get into the on deck circle because for 98 hitters could see it and they were hitting it. And that's a little scary. If you said they wanted to take a guy who throws real hard, it's power stuff. He doesn't throw strikes. They did that with Nick Nastrini a couple of years ago out of UCLA. And he's turned into a prospect. They've improved his command and control, at least to the point where you can see a big league reliever. But the fastball played. In Swan's case, the fastball not playing is definitely a concern. So there are individual players I like in here. I like Geloff for what he is. Wyatt Crowell, when he comes off Tommy John after he was really badly overused at Florida State, he's pretty interesting. Joe Vetrano, the fifth rounder out of BC, college first baseman. But I like the swing. He's got a chance. But just as a whole, the Dodgers seem to have decided the new market inefficiency is pitchers who can't throw strikes.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of having a hard time with that one because I think the strike zone still exists. That is still actually a part of the game. And four balls puts the guy on first. That may have changed overnight. I've been traveling a bit. So let me know if I'm out of date on that.
No, I think that's right on. There was a pack of college players taken, let's see, 12 through 14. Nope, 15. Mm-hmm. That I think there's going to be a real star coming out of here. And I'm gonna mm-hmm. let you pick it. Because a couple of these guys...
I want to know who yours... is there one you looked at and said, I really like this guy?
You had a couple of these guys in your top 10, I think. Matt Schaub, yeah. Kyle Teal, both. For the listener, it went Tommy Troy to the Diamondbacks out of Stanford. Shortstop, mm-hmm. Matt Schaub, shortstop, goes to from Maryland to the Cubs. Kyle Teal, catcher for the UVA, to the Red Sox. And Jacob Gonzalez, Ole Miss, shortstop, to the White Sox. If I had to pick one, I think I'm going Teal. I just think that's an organization mm-hmm. that needs more catching depth, or really a star catcher. And I think Teal, what he did with the bat in college was pretty exceptional. And if he can keep that up, I think that he really has the potential. If you know, so long as he sticks behind the plate and all that, to be a really impact catcher, and that's an organization that needs one.
That's a good pick. I actually think Teal to me is maybe the safest of the group. Like, he is definitely a catcher. He makes a lot of contact. It's pretty good contact. It's not elite contact, but for a catcher, you've just got to hit, right? That's the number one thing. And he's got little issues. Like, a couple of people pointed out to me leading up to the draft, hey, this guy doesn't hit lefties well. He hits them. He just doesn't hit them well. Okay, sure. Those are things you can work on. And that is one thing that, you know, if you show you can make some contact, there are definitely things the Red Sox can do with him to try to improve that. The guy I think's got the best chance to be a star in the group is Shaw. I had him ranked the highest out of everybody. Because I think he can really, really hit, and that it's in his batted ball data, the exit velocities, hard hit rate, barrel rate, et cetera, were all among the best outside of the Cruz Langford duo in the entire first round. And I just think you get Shaw off shortstop, put him at second base and let him go. I think he's got a chance to be a real star. I think that's a great pick for the Cubs. I liked a lot of those picks. I liked the Troy pick. I liked Shaw. I liked Teal. And I liked Enrique Bradfield Jr. went 17th. Between 11 and – I got to scroll down here, don't I? At least in 17, because then I think it kept going. The teens were almost all
– Yeah, Brock Wilkins, Braden Taylor. Yeah,
Braden Taylor, guys I liked for where they were picked, right? So what do we have? Between 11 and 19, we have one high school player? Yeah, that's right. Which is very interesting, and I think really speaks to what everyone said. So all of us who cover the draft, we're seeing the same thing all spring. This is a really good college position player draft, probably in large part the result of the COVID year. It was pretty fantastic run, and if you were team drafting there this year, you had to be ecstatic. The 14th pick in a typical year does not get you the best college catcher in the draft class and a pretty good prospect in his own right. That's a pretty good outcome.
Yeah, and we didn't see a pitcher. We had Chase Dollander at 8, not 9, Noble Meyer at, at 10, and then not another pitcher until Hurst and Waldrop at 24. So I just think there's a ton of value there in the middle of the draft, and teams saw that saw that too. I had a question on the one high schooler in that mix there was Bryce Eldridge, a two-way player, they're saying, for the Giants. Yeah. Giants are falling in love with this model now. Huge kid, 6'7" high schooler. What do you make of that pick? Where does he end up, most likely scenario?
So I'm in the camp that I have him as a hitter and just a hitter. Like, I don't think he's a two-way player. I've seen a couple things. I think the Washington Post even referred to him as the American Ohtani. And I was like, shut the front door. Like, really? I can't. I would swear if this was my own podcast, I'd probably be swearing here. Like, that is ridiculous. And you're not talking to the right people if you're saying that. That is the big problem I have with that. I do not expect the layperson to read something about Bryce Eldridge and immediately say, this guy's not a pitcher, right? But there are a few hundred people out there who are people, and I'm not saying me, like a scout, an executive, a scouting director, a GM, several saw him. He is on the mound, he throws hard. And then the delivery is not bad, actually. Sometimes these two-way guys, too, delivery is like, you know, it's just a disaster and you say it's never going to work. His problem is he's really never shown a second pitch, but he can hit. And he's 6'7". I've obviously talked about that, too. There's a lot of risk with hitters that tall. I give him a little more credit. He's younger going to pro ball. His swing is actually reasonably short. He hits it really hard, which 6'7" guys tend to do. I think there's hit and power there. It's probably going to be a 25% strikeout rate, but if he keeps that in check, he's got a chance to be pretty good. The other issue with him both ways, especially as a pitcher, is it's so hard to develop as either, and you're going to try to develop him as both. I just worry you end up making him worse at both things. I mean, this is an imperfect analogy, but imagine I told you, I need you to go learn German and Chinese at the same time, right? Like, your brain's melting. Now, could you learn both of those languages? Probably. I assume you're a smart guy. You seem like a smart guy. So you probably could, given the right time and resources, but you do it one at a time. And telling Bryce Eldridge to come into pro ball and do both things when he's going to have a ton to work on as a pitcher and a few things to work on as a hitter, certainly, that's a pretty big ask. And I hope this is one of those, the kid really insisted on it. We'll let him do it for a year. And then after that, we'll say, all right, that's cute. You're a hitter now.
Right. Talk to me about what you thought about the Minnesota Twins draft. They went real high school heavy up top. They went Walker Jenkins at number 5, which there's some question whether they would do something different there. Charlie Soto, high school pitcher, Luke Keshal, if I'm saying that right, out of Arizona State, second baseman, and then Brandon Winokur, high school outfielder. What did you end up taking about their haul?
Like the first two a lot. Jenkins was 5th on my board, so I'm in. And they didn't get cute. There were so many rumors out there. And I fully admit I may have just fallen for from some bad gossip, but there was a lot about them not doing that for a variety of reasons. But the good news is for Twins fans, especially, they did. They took the best player. They absolutely took the best player. They had one of the, other than Cruz, you know, if you put Cruz over Lankford, as most people did, as I did, I think the Twins might have had the easiest pick in the entire draft. They picked 5th in a 5-man draft and the first 4 were gone. So good job not overthinking it.
Right.
And look, Charlie Soto, it's the 34th pick. You are technically out of the first round. He has maybe the best 3 pitch mix of any of these high school pitchers in the draft. Just not to say he's the best, but just in terms of the quality of 3 offerings that's there right now. And he hasn't pitched a lot. And there were all kinds of stories like, you know, I was in Florida for a week and he didn't pitch at all because he was on some weird rotation. But that's not the worst thing either. I don't think anybody's worried that Soto was overpitched at any point. And so that's fine. Like, he's your second pick. And at 34, what was still on the board is very different than what's on the board, say, at pick 10. Winokur is not my cup of tea. It's huge, huge power and huge swing and miss. So not really my kind of player. Like, I want guys who have more feel to hit at that age, but I understand what they were going for. He was not on my top 100, but I also completely understand, like, Pipeline had him 74th. I happen to have their rankings are shown on the draft tracker here. And I get it. I totally understand why you might rank that guy there, why you might take that guy there. Just not, that is a category of player that I personally have had a very hard time with. I think that teaching a guy like that to cut down on the swing and miss and to hit more. That's a really big ask for player development.
Well, we're going to leave the draft talk there, but I do reiterate to the listener, go read Keith's stuff. Keith, tell me if I miss anything here. He's got a breakdown of each of the first round picks. He's got a report card for every team out there, breaking down their picks. You'll get a couple lines on everybody. He's got a live Q&A that's going to be going. That'll be done by the time you listen to this, but there's plenty of things and your team was covered. And so we'll move on here. So Keith, the futures game, they have not listened to you yet. It is still a 7-inning game, and to make it even better, it is on Peacock now, so it's harder to find.
Yeah, were you even able to watch it?
Yes, I was able to, but I'm sure everyone and their grandmother weren't all able to. So beyond that, the difficulty that they've turned this event, the difficulty they've thrown into this event, what did you make of the futures game and how it stacked up this year?
I had a great time. It was actually pretty pitching heavy for the rosters going in. I think we all, other writers, like, you know, I saw Kylie McDaniel there. I saw Eric Longenhagen the next day. We were talking about it and I sat with some scouts and we all agreed going in. We thought this was going to be pretty hitter friendly, maybe a high scoring game because the pitching didn't look great on paper, but the pitchers very much rose to the occasion. Most of the guys actually came in through strikes, or at least through enough strikes to keep the game competitive. And yes, it was 5-0, but that was two innings where, you know, somebody just had a little bit of trouble on the mound and that led to a couple of runs and that was it. Otherwise, it was a very brisk game. I think it underscored the fact that we could easily have had two more innings there. If that had been a 9-inning game, it still would have been over in less than 2.5 hours. Nobody likes how short the game is within the industry. Scouts, executives, et cetera. To a person, everyone I have ever brought this up with says, why is this stupid thing 7 innings? We want 9 innings. And most of them bring up the fact that it's hard to watch and it's on. There were still major league games going on when they started this, which is also lousy. Now, I'm not sure I want it like it was 2 years ago where it was in the afternoon at 1 o'clock or whatever at Coors Field. And I had to run over, shower because it was disgusting, burn my clothes, and then run over to the draft. That's not any better.
Yeah.
There were other ways to do this, certainly. But I had a great time. I hope folks who did watch it enjoyed what they saw. You know, one of the great things about this is you read folks like me and Pipeline and Eric and them, we write about these guys, but you can't really see them. You know, you can probably find video clips online. There's nothing like watching a guy in the game. And you obviously for the thousands of people who showed up, you got a pretty good brisk moving game. You saw some pretty cool things. You saw some hard hit balls. You saw a bunch of guys throw really hard. I mean, Jacob Mizrowski, we talk about his delivery, but for two pitches, it's hard to beat what's coming out of his arm. That's fun. Like, I want those guys. You saw Victor Scott a little bit. I wish you'd seen him more, but he's an 80 runner. I'm all in on getting those guys into the game. And then you hope that they get a chance to show off the elite skills. It's such a great showcase game in the very literal sense. We are showcasing our young talent, and except we're kind of not, because you can't watch it and it's only 2 hours, so don't blink and it's over.
Right. And there's no shortage of talent there. There's no reason to be debating which guys should get stuck with one plate appearance, right? Like you right. I don't remember who it was. Someone got like hit by pitch in their only at bat, right?
Yes. Yeah. I'm blanking on who it was, but I was like, are you kidding me? apparently Marcelo Mayer, I heard that maybe the Red Sox said they only wanted him to get one at bat, which to me, like, don't put him on the plane. Like, of course I want Marcelo Mayer there. He's top 10 prospect in baseball. Like, he should be there. He made a great play in the first inning. He got a hit. And then I don't even know if he was still in the state of Washington when the game ended. Like, why are we doing this? Like, everyone should get 2 at bats. Every pitcher should get to, at least on paper, get a full inning. Now, I've suggested this for literally 15 years now. Just if you're the host team, your responsibility is to pick 2 basically non-prospecty pitchers, org pitchers, preferably guys who throw strikes, who will be at the ballpark and they'll be paid for their time, but they will only pitch if all hell breaks loose, right? The guy comes in and throws 9 straight pitches out of the strike zone because he's overwhelmed, whatever. And you have to make a change, right? That happens most years anyway. So if you're worried about running out of pitching, they've just got to cover. So what? That's easy enough to fix. But this idea, like, imagine I had, a player family members say, you know, you're asking these kids to fly, you know, in many cases across the country to get one at bat, to throw five pitches. Like, is that even worth it? Like, they do it. I've never heard of a player saying they don't want to do it, but it's kind of probably feels pretty lousy if you're the kid who comes in and gets that one at bat, you get hit by a pitch. It's not even an at bat. Or we've had plenty of guys over the years come in and literally throw a single pitch, get an out, and it's the end of their day.
Yeah. It was Dodgers catcher Dalton Rushing, who we've talked about before,
yes,
on the show.
That's right.
Great player.
Want to see him.
Would love to see some more at bats.
Yeah.
Would love to see some more at bats. Yeah. So once again, I'm throwing air quotes on this. The problem we saw with both this game and the All-Star game is pitching is so good right now. And so even if you have something that's billed as this, I mean, it's like the best lineups you're going to see all year. Pitching is so dominant right now. And in one-off showings, if these guys are throwing one inning and they gas it mm-hmm. up, they get a couple more miles per hour there, you're just going to end up seeing some pretty low scoring games. So anyone there that you hadn't seen live in a while, that sort of surprised you, that went maybe quite a bit, looking quite a bit different than they did the last time you saw them in person?
I mean, I will say Mick Abel threw a lot harder, and I did see him last year. And of course, you know, it's like you said, are they just amped up for the event and throwing harder as a result? Maybe. Carson Wisenhunt I'd seen 5 days earlier or 6 days earlier, but he was a totally different guy. He was way better at the Futures game. I saw him walk five guys in two innings the Sunday right before. I'd never seen Spencer Schwellenbach because he got drafted in the second round and immediately underwent Tommy John surgery. He'd never pitched professionally until this year. So that was a pretty fun one. You know, he's interesting. I got, you know, guys I was sitting with were like, this is a little reliever-ish. And I said, I don't disagree, but he's barely pitched. So definitely let him get, I'd like to let him get some more starts under his belt mm-hmm. and see what else Atlanta can do. Cause obviously they've got a pretty good track record in that department. So definitely like to see more of him. Had actually never seen Justin Crawford, knew who he was in the draft last year, obviously, just never could fit him into my schedule, and was impressed by the quality of his at-bats and also his BP. I only saw the NL BP because my flight was late, but his BP was pretty good. Like, for a guy who has not put on a lot of his so-called man strength, he was driving the ball the other way very impressively, which makes me think he gets 10 or 20 pounds on him. There might be more power than anybody anticipated. And that was something everyone said about his dad when I was with the Blue Jays. There was an expectation Carl was going to get to more power when he got stronger. Carl filled out, but he didn't necessarily get stronger. So let's say Justin, you know, hopefully fills out and it's muscle and we get to 20 plus home run power when he gets to his peak.
It's just a matter of time before we see Spencer Strider handing off to Spencer Schwellenbach for a combined no-hitter. Spencer S, just what the Braves needed. So the kind of the star of the show in this game was Brewers right-hander Jacob Mizrowski. Eno Sarah said he had the first, third, and eighth best pitches in, by Stuff Plus in the game. You just said he had the best stuff. So same thing, different different words. What did you make of his start or his outing?
I'd seen him before. I'd seen him in May in a three inning start. You know, he's been on pretty tight pitch counts. It's the same thing. He just threw a little harder this time. He was up to 102 in the Futures game. I think he was up to 99 when I saw him in May, which is pretty good, you know, example of just guys, you know, they know they're only in for about 15, 20 pitches, so they can air it out. You know, it's an elite fastball. It's an elite slider. We're debating with some of the scouts behind the plate. Is that an 80 fastball or a 70 fastball? I don't think it really matters. Like, the fastball can miss bats. The slider is definitely going to miss bats. I'm not on the delivery at all. Like, I do not see how that guy could possibly be a starter. I don't think he's ever going to have close to enough command and control to be able to start, even before considering needs a third pitch to turn a lineup over a couple of times, et cetera. It's just, starters don't look like that. I mean, that's the easiest way I would explain it to somebody who doesn't do this for a living, is just watch him. And how many guys do you see in a rotation, even if they're only throwing 80 pitches at a time, throw like that? Nobody. I mean, I think the answer is pretty much nobody. Nobody who's ever held up, certainly, or had success. But, you know, could he be a right-handed Josh Hader type for the Brewers? Yeah, actually, I think that's very much within reach. It would be a great outcome for them. Because I know that the TrackMan data on his stuff has always been elite. Like, it is nuts how much life he gets on the fastball, how sharp the break is on the slider. It kind of all checks out. I mean, the ultimate test is, do hitters hit it? And the answer is no. And occasionally when they hit it, they generally don't hit it very well. And I think that's going to continue as he moves up the ladder. I will be curious to see, because developmentally, you know, it often makes sense to let a guy like that start just so he can continue to work on repeating the delivery if you want him to develop another pitch. But at some point, they may just look at him and say, we know you're a reliever.
Yeah.
We could probably use you in the big leagues, right? That could happen pretty soon.
Yeah, the path is just going to be quicker if you got a guy coming out of the bullpen and you see the full display of what he has in those one inning stints, and like we just saw in this outing. And yeah, if a guy's throwing one, you know, sitting 100 with a little bit of 102 in there, that guy can be an impactful reliever. And that's a team that has been known for having a good bullpen in recent years, and it's desperate to have some hitting help. And they had Jackson Chourio in that game as well. What did you make of seeing Jackson?
Yeah, I wish he'd had a hit, but not a lot of guys had hits. Nobody had two, so I also, you know, I'm not going to hold that against anybody, but hopefully if you saw the game too, you could see the crazy bat speed. It's the hand speed too, that he can let the ball travel on him and gets that bat started so quickly with such force that he's going to continue, I think, to be able to make a lot of adjustments to pick up pitch types and adjust to them. Even as the pitching continues to get better, he's 19 in AA, I believe he is or was. Now Jackson Holliday's in AA also. I think Chourio's even younger than Holliday. I think they're the only two 19-year-olds in AA, and Chourio's been there all year. And he's not had a great season on the surface until you consider his age relative to his level. He's super athletic. I don't even think he's begun to fill out. He can really run. He can really play center. The upside there is really exciting. And I think we've got kind of a fun debate. You know, last winter, it was Corbin Carroll or Gunnar Henderson. Who you got? And there wasn't a wrong answer. They were both great prospects. I kind of feel a little bit like that with these two, where Holliday's obviously had much better performance. He plays shortstop. He was the first pick in the draft. That doesn't make him a better prospect, but it sort of weights our opinions of him. Him versus Chourio, who's probably a little bit more long-term potential, but I think offers more upside. Also plays up the middle, but center's not as valuable as shortstop. What do you like? They're both great prospects. I go back and forth. Yeah, after that game, I was probably, if you'd asked me walking out of there, which took forever because nobody could figure out how to get out of the stadium, I probably would have said Holliday, and now I'm kind of leaning back the other way. And I don't know. Like I said, I don't think there's a wrong answer. I think they're both great prospects. They are the top two in the minors, however you stack them up.
Fans will never understand how much trouble sports writers have getting out of stadiums. It gets difficult, okay, after the gates close. Jackson Chourio is a March 2004 birthday. Jackson Holliday is a December 2003 birthday. So we're talking 03s and 04s. This is frightening, and also a good reminder that as when we were having our boys, we just threw the name Jackson out the window. We said everyone's a Jackson.
There's too many Jacksons.
Too many Jacksons. Well,
with my daughter, who's now a teenager, it was too many Aidens. And then looking at the draft this year, right? We had at least one Aiden in the first round. I think there were a couple of others. Yeah, I guess. Well, she wasn't a boy anyway, so that took it out. But also, it was like, nope, can't do that. We weren't going to do Aiden, and we weren't going to do any version of Emma, Emily, Emmeline, any of those, because it was like, there's way too many of these running around.
All right, well, that's going to do it for us. Time for us to go. Thank you for listening. You can find our work all week long at theathletic.com. Please read Keith's work, read the live Q&A, a lot of interesting stuff that's going to be there. Subscribe to The Athletic for $1 per month for the first year at theathletic.com/baseball show during our summer sale. Give us a follow on Twitter. Keith is at Keith Law, and I'm at Stephen J. Nesbitt. Give Keith a follow on all the other socials as well. The Athletic Baseball Show will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend.